This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evans Arcadas, your host. And in today's episode, I will be speaking with Dr. Yannis Touraitis about his recent book, Identities and Ideologies in the Medieval Eastern Roman World, published in 2022 by Edinburgh University Press. Dr. Touraitis is Senior Lecturer in Byzantine History at the University of Edinburgh. He specializes in Byzantine social and cultural history, focusing on the socio-ideological aspects of war, collective identification and ideological attachments, and the construction of historical memory. Hello, Yanni, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Evan, and thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
Absolutely. It's a great pleasure. These past few months, I've been really looking into bringing so many more Byzantine books into the attention of a broader field. So I'm very happy to be speaking with you today.
Well, I'm very happy as well to be here, and I'm looking forward to a great discussion, and I really enjoy your podcast. So I'm very happy to be here.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, I would like to start our conversation by you telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm what people call a Byzantine historian or Byzantinist, a title I don't like to use very much for myself. I prefer to think of myself as a historian of the Middle Ages or pre-modern times in general. I'm Greek originally, but I'm based in Edinburgh the last 5 years. I was born in Athens, raised in Chalkiva, which is a city with both an ancient and a medieval past. So I had kind of influences from both sides, so to say. I went to Ioannina to study and the University of Ioannina, where I was kind of like between modern Greek history and Byzantine history. So I was like, I didn't know what to do really because I liked both. In the end, I decided for Byzantine history, and yeah, this is what brought me here, so to say.
Perfect. Yeah, quite a story. Yeah, definitely the move from Greece, familiar with my past, with my history as well. So
obviously I went to Vienna afterwards to study, to do my PhD, which was a great move, in my view. One of the best decisions I've made in my life, I believe. It was a great experience. And yeah, I stayed there for many years, and I was able to benefit a lot from this great Institute for Byzantine Studies, which is probably, which is one of the best in the world, if not the best place to study Byzantine history.
Yes, yes. And for those who don't know who you are, you have been very active recently in the field when it comes to studying the identity of the area of what we call today Byzantium. And more than the identity, but I've got to know you through your works on looking into the identity of Romanness, for example, in Byzantium.
Yeah, yeah, it is true. Identity research is one major aspect of my research interests. I started working on ideology, especially ideas about war and peace. That was the topic of my PhD in Vienna. And I did a lot on just war and holy war and questions of war ethics in my early years. And it was through these questions, actually, that I came. I mean, through warfare, the social aspects of warfare, that I came to the question of identity, identifications, collective identifications. And I've been very interested since to study and explore the way the people we used to call Byzantines identified themselves collectively or distinguished themselves from others.
Right. Yes. And yeah, I try to remind myself to call them Romans.
Although
it's, you know, with all the books, you know, it's Romans.
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad to call them Byzantines as long as you know that that's an analytical term. Like it's a modern term. Yes. It's not kind of their identity that they use for themselves. Yeah. It's not the end of the world if you call them Byzantines.
Right. Yes, I know the previous podcast I did was about the invention of Byzantium in early medieval Europe. So it was a lot about, you know, that term and its history and how we're using it today. So I'm glad to continue that now. So thank you for answering that question. So let's talk about, you know, a little bit about what is this book about and where did really the idea for the book come from? So the title is Identities and Ideologies in the Medieval Eastern Roman World. And it was published fairly recently, I think maybe a month or two ago. So I'm quite quick to get an interview with you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what is the book about? I think the title is pretty much straightforward. It's about identities and ideologies. I think what may struck people as kind of different is the fact that I've chosen to talk about medieval East Roman world and not Byzantine world. That was, to be honest, I was not trying to make a statement with that we should not use the term Byzantium anymore. It was more of a way to provoke a bit people to reflect more about why do we use certain terms about this pre-modern society? Why do we use certain labels and not others? So the title of the book kind of relates with my own chapter in the book, which is about the very topic you mentioned before, about why and how did we come to the label Byzantine, and in particular then how does this label influence modern research, the way modern research is conducted on questions of ideology and identity in the Byzantine world. So I chose to talk about the medieval East Roman world, which is which many people may find also equally problematical as a label, because it has the term medieval and it has the term East. But as I said, it was more of a way to provoke people to think about why should we use certain labels and not others, rather than make a statement that this is the correct label and not the other. I very much use the label Byzantine still. And as I said before, I truly believe that it's more about how we use it and not whether we use it or not.
Right. And how did it come to, where did this idea come from?
How did the idea, so this was actually the book, which is a collected volume. Yes, it's not my book. It has many different authors, great authors. It's the product of a workshop which took place in Vienna back in 2015. When I was still a postdoctoral researcher there. So it took a long time to materialize, and there were many reasons for this great delay. The workshop was part of a project that I was leading at the time in Vienna, under the title Ideologies Under Scrutiny: Differentiated Perceptions of Roman Imperial Ideas in Byzantine Society in the Period Between the 7th and the 12th Centuries, a project was funded by the Austrian science funds. I worked 3 years on that topic. And this workshop was kind of the culminating moment of the project. So it was an opportunity for me to invite many distinguished scholars and some also good friends among them to discuss about that topic, which I believed at the time and still believe it's very interesting. So on the way then, some people abandoned the ship. Some people that participated in the workshop abandoned the ship, but new people came on board. And this is now the final outcome of that cooperation with a number of scholars, as I said. I'm particularly happy because I was able to work together with people that I used to read their books and publications and with I would say, and great admiration, like Jean-Claude Chenet or Jonathan Shepherd or Leslie Brubaker or Panayotis Agapitos, and they did me the honor to participate in the conference and contribute to the discussion with excellent contributions. And of course, there are a number of younger scholars also, so kind of scholars of my own generation, comrades in arms, I would call them, with whom we are also friends, more or less, and who also participated, like Kostis Mirlis, Denis Tathakopoulos, Alicia Simpson, and of course, all the others, Vlada Stankovic. So I was very happy to have a mixture, so to say, of old and younger generation of Byzantinists, and also some medievalists as well, Francesco Bori or Annick Peters Cousteau. So yes, I think the book is a nice mixture of people, of scholars with great experience, also fresh ideas. And I think that's what makes it interesting in the first place.
Right. Yes. Yes. There's 16 articles or papers in the book. 16 chapters.
Yeah.
So quite a variety of scholars and different topics as well from many areas of the Eastern medieval world, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Exactly. Of course, 16 chapters and plus the introduction, which I wrote. Right. Which John Halden and I wrote together, John doing most of the hard work, I would say, on that, and me contributing with some extra ideas. So, yeah.
Great, great. Sounds like it was a great conference.
It was fun. It was fun, definitely. Yeah. It was fun at the time, yes.
I gave birth to this work. So, I guess the question that makes sense to ask next is, you know, why look at identity in Byzantium? I've personally been interested in the field and working with the field. I see a lot of not so recent, but also recent interest in looking at identity in Byzantium, especially the past. I mean, you're the expert. You will be able to know better the past 10 years or maybe earlier than that of this increased interest in looking at and exploring and learning more about identity in Byzantium. So, yeah, why look at identity in Byzantium and what has been the state of the field when it comes to studying this particular topic as we speak right now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the answer to the question why look at identity in Byzantium is kind of obvious in the sense that identity is a major research topic for a longer period of time now, but especially in the last two decades, there has been a resurgent interest in the question of collective identities, and Byzantinists are kind of like riding the wave, I would say, in the sense that they have to participate in these discussions. You have to be part of them. You can't like just ignore them. And on the other hand, the debate over Byzantine identity goes back in time. It was a hotly debated issue already in the 20th century, at a very early stage, already since the 19th century, the late 19th century, if we want to really look back. So, and it's very much interrelated with question of national identities, how modern national states have tried to actually influence research on Byzantine identity, because they make claim to claims to Byzantine culture as their own national culture, as part of their national narrative about the past of their own nation and their own culture. So I would say that if we want to talk about the state of the field, we could like roughly divide identity research on the Byzantine society in two major periods. I mean, the first period is the period from the late 19th century to the late 20th century, where the basic question was actually, and the hotly debated issue was, whether the Byzantines were Greeks or not. So it was basically a question between Greek national historians, historians either of Greek origin or based in Greece or abroad, who were very keen to stress the Greek elements of being of Byzantine identity and prove it as an inherent part of the trajectory of a Greek national identity. On the other hand, there was a great deal of scholars basically based outside Greece at Western, at the universities of the Western world, who actually mainly argued for the opposite, that Byzantium, it was not a Greek empire in the Middle Ages. It was not a. It did not represent the continuation of the Greek nation in the Middle Ages. So that was the basic debate up to the 90s, the 1990s. The last decade of the previous century. And I think it was this major turn in the humanities also that took place by the turn of the century. So at the beginnings of the 21st century, with all these new theories, ethno-symbolism, which made a major, which kind of forced scholars to look anew to the question of continuities and discontinuities of ethnicity in the past. And all that obviously affected also the field of Byzantine studies. And then a new round of discussion began, which now does not focus anymore, I think, on the question whether the Byzantines were Greeks or not. That is an issue that is considered solved, I believe, with very minor exceptions. The majority of scholars nowadays would not enter in such a debate anymore. It's not a matter of debate. Now, the questions that we pose now is, what kind of identity was the collective identity of the Byzantines? How can we conceptualize it? How should we understand it? And it focuses on questions of ethnicity, nationhood. If you look at recent publications, you will see questions about whether the Byzantines regarded themselves as an elect nation, for instance, or if whether they were a nation state and not an empire. So this research has moved on to new questions, which are, obviously the questions that are being asked internationally and within various disciplines and various fields. So as I said, there's an obvious influence from that. And on the other hand, of course, the Byzantine case is a very interesting case, which has a lot to say to these discussions. It has also a lot to offer to contribute to current sociological debates as well about how should we understand the question of the longevity of nations or a pre-modern ethnicity, the relationship between pre-modern ethnicity and nationhood, all these questions, which are sociological questions, but also historical questions. I think the Byzantine paradigm, Byzantine case study, has a lot to contribute to that because it's a very interesting case study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yes, there's so much to cover there. And I guess the follow-up to that will be, so where does this new contribution to these questions, your recent publication, where does that book stand with this current scholarship and research trends?
Yeah, this volume was actually intended to move the discussion a bit forward because it has focused a lot on certain issues as to whether the Byzantines were a Roman nation or not, whether Byzantium was a nation state or an empire. So I wanted to move the discussion a bit away from all that. It's not that I'm not considering these issues to be important, but I do not think they should monopolize discussion on identities in Byzantium. So this is also why the plural in the title, identities and ideologies. We are not talking about Byzantine identity or Roman identity, and we are not talking only about Roman ideology. We are trying to offer a more inclusive view with regard to identifications on various levels. So, I mean, if you look at the various articles, for instance, yes, so they are dealing with high-level identities, but also with low-level identities. They are dealing mm-hmm. with high-level ideology, but also with low-level ideas and values within society. And obviously, if you look at my introductory chapter, at the introductory chapter by John and myself, we have tried there to offer a methodological framework, which we believe, both of us, that it is very important to be clarified. And so we wanted kind of to make a statement with that paper of how do we approach very important analytical terms such as identity and ideology, which we consider to be very central in our research. And I do believe that people very often do not really reflect on the terms that they use, and that can lead to great problems. There's a great discussion right now in sociology about, for instance, the use of the term identity, whether it makes sense to use the term, how useful it is as an analytical concept, yes? And of course, ideology is also a very contentious term. A contentious term, analytical term, which needs to be defined very carefully if you want to use it in a useful way, in order to think about the past and understand certain phenomena of the past. So the basic goal of this book, as I said, was to open up the discussion, make us think also about different kind of identities, not just Romanes as a collective identity, or not just Roman political ideology, which are, of course, very... there are topics who have like, they sell very well, so to say. You can make like a name by writing on them, but they're not the only interesting topics. So when it comes to research, to exploring identity or identities in plural and ideologies in the medieval East Roman world, I think it's much more there to explore than the question of, okay, were the Byzantines Romans and how did they conceive themselves as Romans? Or was Roman and political ideology absolutist, or was it not absolutist? And how did the Roman imperial state function? So I think that's the main statement that the book is trying to make. So to open up the discussion and to actually point towards new directions for research.
Right, and kind of get the ball rolling when it comes to the study of identity.
Exactly.
Yes. So I find something interesting from what you mentioned about the question of the use of the term identity, as you mentioned, especially like in sociological circles, I guess. Why will that happen, especially now that we kind of have seemed to progress a little further?
Well, I mean, I think it's exactly the result of that progression. I mean, it's like, research progresses when theory it's kind of been contested and redefined, so to say. I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect theory. Theory is there to be, I think, reconsidered and revisited all the time and redefined. And I think within this context, I actually see the criticism of the concept of identity as part of this great dialogue that began in the 1990s. And it began with ethno-symbolism, which made a contribution. An important contribution in the sense that it went against the stream, especially with the studies of Anthony D. Smith, who, as much as I do not agree with him in everything, I must be clear, I'm not a great fan of ethno-symbolism. It was a very brave thing to do when he began, because modernism was the current orthodoxy towards the end of the previous century. and he was the one to go against the stream. And of course, he offered like very interesting ideas, some of them very useful, to be honest. He kind of, I would say, he helped de-demonizing ethnicity in the sense, especially from the point of view, I mean, it was a very strong belief towards the end of the 20th century that we're not allowed to talk about ethnicity at all in the past and so on and so forth. So he helped a lot, I think, with his studies. He made a contribution in order to reinstitute ethnicity as an analytical term and try to help also historians understand how they can use this term in a way that it can be heuristically helpful. Of course, on the other hand, there are many things to criticize about his theories, especially when it comes to the continuity of national identities or how ethnicity and modern national identity kind of overlap. But of course, this is not our the topic of our discussion now. I'm just mentioning that because I think that then criticism of the very concept of identity came as a reaction from parts of the modernist camp who also were forced by the studies of the ethno-symbolists to refine their own arguments, so to go away from a vulgar modernism, which, as I said, until the end of the previous century, was not willing to see any kind of identity, collective identities in pre-modern societies, any kind of was not willing to allocate any kind of role to ethnicity or political identities or whatever. In pre-modern times, or very little at least. So, and I find this whole discussion very interesting and very fruitful because it can help us also rethink, as I said, the concepts that we are using, and we should be very careful when you're using certain concepts. For instance, if you look at the paper, at the introduction we wrote with John, we particularly talk about the question of, I mean, how problematic can be modern approaches to identity can be sometimes, hard senses of identity or very soft senses of identity. So, I mean, weak understandings, as we say in the text, weak understandings of identity and strong understandings, how problematic both can be, yes. I mean, weak understandings are usually characterized by a meaningless, cliched constructivism, which ends up repudiating the core meaning of the identity of the term it employs. Yes, so it becomes meaningless, the term. And on the other hand, you have like strong understandings, which bear refined connotations, and they result in the use of the term, which is intended to assert internal sameness, distinctiveness, bounded groupness, making identity a condition rather than a process, yes, which is equally problematical, of course. I mean, we are giving birth to something that probably did not exist in the past, so to say, when we use identity in that way. So, yeah, I mean, we are trying to make a state. We tried actually to take into account all these developments in the field of historical sociology, which are very useful, and try to translate them to our field and see how we can propose a certain way to approach these questions that can be useful and fruitful for our research. Of course, this is an introductory paper, and one could write like another 50 pages on that issues, and it would still not be enough. So we would by no means claim that we did cover the topic or whatever. But as I said, our main goal was to initiate a discussion and to provide an alternative perspective from the one that is currently kind of dominant in the discussions about identity within the field of Byzantine studies.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Right, right. So you think that, based on your opinion, do you believe that scholars or, you know, whoever studies this sometimes might be using more of modern concepts of identity rather than looking at the sources and seeing how they perceived what we call, I guess, identifications?
Well, I mean, I'm very fond of modern concepts because we need them. We need analytical concepts to conceptualize. We need them in order to give meaning to phenomena, to the phenomena that we are studying. So we cannot do without them. As I said, it's important that when we use our concepts, we define them very clearly and that we use definitions that are actually not tentative, so to say. I mean, it's very important that our definitions help us understand the phenomenon in the best possible way through our sources, rather than determining how the phenomenon should be understood. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but I think this is a very fine distinction. So definitions are very important. And actually, Roger Brubaker, who's one of the most important modern sociologists on regarding ideology research, has devoted the whole paper about how we should distinguish our categories of analysis from our categories of practice when we talk about identity. So, for instance, how we define terms like nation, ethnic group, state, or whatever. It's very important that we as historians, as academics, take particular care to distinguish our categories of analysis from the categories of practice, because we do use many of our analytical terms also as categories of practice in our everyday language. And that can lead very often to misunderstandings when we confuse the two. And So I'm very much in favor of using analytical terms as long as they are very well defined and carefully defined. And I think this is where a lot of work needs to be done by everyone who works in the field, because there is a vast amount of bibliography on the topic. And of course, the easiest thing to do is always to base yourself on one single book, take one single theory, apply it, and write a book. This is very easy to do, especially in medieval history when we have written sources, and it's very easy to cherry pick the material that can be fitted into a certain theory, and then use it to verify that theory. Yes, and there you have a nice book. But the question then you have to pose to yourself is, how does that respond then to questions posed by other theories? And how does that respond to questions posed by the contradictions of our own evidence? So the evidence that we overlook or we leave aside because it doesn't really fit into the theory. So I think this is the greatest challenge when we are dealing with questions like that, where the theoretical baggage, the theoretical background is great and is vast. And so you have to try kind of to control, to harness it before going to your sources and trying to use that theoretical methodological background in a fruitful way in order to interpret the material of your sources in a holistic manner, leaving nothing out, so to say.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. That's why, you know, sometimes I say the job of the historian is the hardest job out there.
Well, it is. That's true. It's quite hard. And I mean, we have to be honest here that also becoming a Byzantinist is a quite difficult thing, because you need to be good at both nowadays. So you need to have like technical expertise, like being able to read in medieval Greek, which is the basic thing that have to be able to do. But you must also be able to understand numismatics, paleography, and a series of technical skills that people need to master in order to be able to approach to have access to the great range of sources that this past society offers us. And on the other hand, of course, they have also to be very well equipped in terms of theory and methodology. Sociological theory and methodology or literary theories, for instance. And all of that, coupled by the need to speak, to read at least three or four like modern languages, because bibliography in Byzantine studies is not predominantly in English. It's also in German, very important publications in French, in Italian, even in Russian, for instance, you can find very interesting and important publications. So that makes it very hard. And it's not also, I mean, to train as a Byzantinist means a lot of hard work, and it's not certain that it's going to be rewarded always. So yeah, it's a dangerous choice to make nowadays.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you for that. So I guess we'll dive a little more deeper into one particular aspect, and not too much of a time, but if you can talk to me a little bit about your, you know, part of your introduction as you co-wrote and your article, your first chapter, the difference between the metropolitan or the Constantinopolitan identity and the provincial Roman identity. I'm particularly interested in that part of the scholarship. So I wanted to see, you know, what has your study shown about this difference that I also see quite often now when it comes to new publications of papers?
Yeah,
that distinction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is kind of an obvious distinction, of course, and it's also very obvious when one looks at the sources, primary sources, which are. The vast majority of those sources after the 7th century, of course, was produced in Constantinople. So they do project mainly the Constantinopolitan viewpoint, which makes things very difficult, of course, for historians to understand what was going on in the provinces. Of course, there is a number of alternative sources that that one may use in order to understand and approach identities in the provinces. And of course, there are various articles in our book which are specifically focused on these kinds of provincial identities, different kind of identities, and different kind of sources that can shed light on these different identities. Obviously, when we're talking about the Constantinopolitan identity, of course, we should distinguish between the urban identity of the city of Constantinople and, of course, the Roman identity of Constantinople, which is per se the Roman community within the Roman community in the East. I mean, Constantinople is the new Rome, yes. So so it is the main focus of Roman identity in the East. And of course, it is the main one of the two main foci of identity of Romanes after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. I mean, the other one being obviously Rome in the West, which people tend to forget. I mean, very often there are also other Romans in that world that they very much have their own, to call themselves Romans. Actually, they are the very Romans in the first place, the Romans of the city of Rome. Yes. So, I mean, when people ask me why East Roman world, yes, because we need conceptualization. We need to distinguish. And even though the Byzantine Empire was the single Roman Empire in the world between the late 5th and century and the year 800 before Charlemagne made his claim in the West, birth to a new Roman Empire there, which of course was Roman in a very different way than the Eastern Empire. But we should also remember that we need to distinguish between different phenomena. So we need ways to conceptualize these distinctions, yes? So this is also why it's Roman world, because there is also another Roman world, as small as it may be, it's the world of the city of Rome, which, as I said, is a Roman identity par excellence. That doesn't mean that the Byzantines, that their Roman identity was not a true Roman identity, whatever the word true may mean for an identity. I'm just saying that we need terms to conceptualize, so we cannot simply speak about the Roman Empire or about the Romans, because that would confuse things. And right. So we need kind of distinguish. But to come back to the question about Constantinople, so Constantinople is the Roman community per se, and you can see that at the sources, for instance, yes? Byzantine authors, when they talk about the Romans as a collective historical subject with an agency, they usually primarily mean the emperor and the people of Constantinople. And they are very keen sometimes to distinguish them from the people of the provinces. And you can see that, I mean, in the language they use, how they call the people of the provinces, tributary, for instance, epophori. They use the word epophori for the people of the provinces to the Romans. They say, even though the people of the provinces that they refer to are also Romans. So these are the contradictions of our material that I was talking about before, that we should account for when we are thinking about Romanness and questions of identity. We believe that it is worth paying particular attention to that differences. For instance, if you look at the paper by Jean-Claude Chenet in this volume, he's particularly arguing about, I mean, he's talking about high-level identities. It's one of the papers that is focusing on the question of high-level identities, and in particular on the question of Romanness. And so he argues against the view that Romanness in Constantinople and Romanness in the provinces was one and the same thing. So using as an example, for instance, provincial revolts and how do they reflect identification with the center or disloyalty towards the center, and what can that tell us about identity as a process, as I said, and not as a condition. So again, we go back to our theoretical background, which is hard. Strong notions of identity, which can be fairly problematical. Yes. And so I think our main interest and our main goal was to promote awareness about and refine actually that distinction that is very evident in the scholarship. Of course, it's not a new distinction. Scholars tended to already in the 20th century, scholars have accentuated that difference, yes? What we are proposing here is an even more refined approach to that by paying attention, as I said, to the various kinds of provincial identities that we should actually pay attention to. I could mention here the paper of the one is an archaeological paper by Fotini Condilli, which shows how local identity in Athens, medieval Athens, how it was constructed in terms of architecture, for instance, where a basic role is played by non-elites, and of course not by the imperial center, by the locals, where non-elite people were very much interested in constructing architecturally the landscape of their own city, independently from what the imperial center may have thought, or actually independently of the resources of the imperial center. And on the other hand, of course, there is the paper by Dan Reynolds, a very interesting one about rural identities in Palestine and Arabia, in these provinces in the 6th century, which again tells us a great deal about how people constructed identifications which had nothing to do with high-level identity, or were neither in a dialogue with it nor interested to use it. These people were not interested to use this identity to identify at a higher level. That was not their main interest, so to say. So I believe this is where this volume tries to make a new contribution to these old questions, so to say. It's not the question which is new, but it's the way to approach it and to look at it from different angles that I believe offers new insights.
Right, right. And the book is I think following up what you're saying, the book is split in two parts. The first is called Top Down and Bottom Up Approaches, and the second one, Center and Periphery. Yeah. How did those come to be? Like, when the was that the targets of the conference and the subsequent publication, or is that something that came after all the papers trickled in?
Well, I mean, when we organized the workshop, we sent out invitations personally, so we chose the speakers. So it was not an open call for papers. We chose the speaker, so to say. So we did have in mind what each person may be able to contribute based on their current research, their current interests, and their current approaches. And so, and one of the basic issues of the volume is, and of my, which comes out of my own research and my own interest, is how the concepts of identity and ideology overlap to some extent, or can be seen as overlapping, and how useful it is to understand identification as a kind of thought action, of an ideological practice. Yes, so we kind of tried to combine the two when we were inviting people. And the outcome of that was, of course, that we got like a number of proposals back about what they would like to present, which they were pretty much close to what we had wished for, so to say, in terms of a broader thematic. So then at the end, of course, the current distinction, the current division of the book between a part about top-down and bottom-up approaches and a part about center and periphery came about as a result of what people propose and how we could see then these topics fitting together into greater thematic groups. And as I said, the workshop in itself was a result, or it was kind of the culminating part of my own research at the time of a project which was very much focusing on identity and ideology in the Byzantine world, from trying to more or less to adopt a bottom-up approach. But of course, we wanted the book, we wanted to be more inclusive. So we had both like papers which provide the top-down views of ideology, for instance, of ideas, and how these create identifications or not, and to which extent they create identifications. Or then bottom-up approaches, as I mentioned, the papers of Fotini and Dan, for instance. There are also other interesting papers which kind of combine the two, like Leslie's paper, which is about processions and the way they created cohesion and urban identity, but at the same time promoting the imperial concept, the imperial identity of Constantinople, and so on. And of course, there's the question of center and periphery, because we did want to include also this is why we use also the term world in the title, Roman world, not Roman Empire, not Byzantium in the sense of a state, because obviously this is more inclusive. So we have like the cases of Serbia, which can be considered a culture which belongs to the broader geopolitical sphere of what we call the East Roman world, the Byzantine world, of course, or a paper on Ravenna by Francesco Borri, who is very interesting about how Roman identity or Byzantine identity view, if you like, in order to distinguish, was viewed by the Ravennites in the aftermath of the fall of the Exarchate. And of course, the question of the imperial Sicily, of Norman imperial Sicily, where you have all this Norman imperial ideology, which is very much influenced by Byzantine conceptions, and the way then actually the various our confessional communities were integrated through that imperial ecumenical ideology there, which all these belong to the periphery of what we would call the Byzantine world, in either cultural or political terms. So yes, we wanted to have that aspect as well. I mean, as I said, this is not a volume that we would like to focus on Constantinople. So actually Constantinople makes a very small part of the interests of the authors of that volume. And this is something that was a kind of a conscious choice of ours. Right. Yes.
Right, yeah, and it was very interesting to see how many takes different scholars took and from different areas, different locations, different perceptions. So it's quite a diverse look into these topics that I really enjoyed while I was reading. It wasn't about one thing. It was so encompassing so many different aspects while researching that particular question. Well, perfect. I've taken a lot of your time. I appreciate it, Yanni. Thank you so much. I think we did a pretty good justice to the book. A little bit about, you know, the what it's about and the concepts. The last question I have for you is before you go, what are you up to nowadays? And if you have any new projects that you are working on?
Well, I'm currently trying to work on a new book, which is going to be about civil war in Byzantium. So I would like to write a book on civil war as a social phenomenon in Byzantium in the period between the 7th and 12th centuries, and try to see how this phenomenon, what role did it play in the historical development of the East Roman polity from the 7th to the 12th century. So that is my basic project at the moment. Of course, I have a couple of ongoing projects which are about to be finished. I'm going to be publishing soon a new collected volume on war and collective identities in the Middle Ages, which is a comparative volume, a cross-cultural approach to the question of how warfare and collective identity interconnect in the history of medieval societies, which is a book I enjoyed very much editing, I have to say, because I learned a lot from the papers of my colleagues that wrote on different social orders, like there are papers on China, the Mongols, the Vikings, and many other societies, Bulgars, Armenians, Islam, of course, and Byzantium, my own paper. So that's one project that it should hopefully be out next year, the volume. And of course, there's currently another volume I'm working on together with Claudia Rapp, as Professor Byzantine Studies at the University of Vienna, a volume on mobility and microstructures in Byzantine society, which probably will also be coming out in 2023. Yeah, so these are my two immediate projects now that have to be finished. But as I said, my main work at the moment is on preparing the monograph on Byzantine civil war.
You sound very busy. Best of luck. Best wishes to the current book, but also to all the forthcoming books as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I wish all the best to you and your podcast, which is very interesting, and well done for the good job that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much again. Thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation, and take care.
Thank you very much. You too.